My name's Sarah Pascoe, and this is episode 4 of the Sex Power Money podcast. This week, I'm talking to two incredibly interesting people. Annabelle and Bella are sex workers, and they run the Whores Handbags Instagram account. So I wanted to start actually with your Instagram account, because I guess what I wanted to do is start off talking about that and why you guys set it up.
We set it up basically after we worked together for the first time, or at least that's when we had the idea, because we just met on a booking and we went, did we go for dinner afterwards, after that booking?
No, that was the second booking we did together.
Oh, right. Okay. Oh, right. So it was the second booking we did, and then we went for dinner, and we ended up talking about all the weird stuff that we carry around with us. You know, like we're sitting there in a restaurant having dinner together, but in our bags, we've got all number of sex toys and God knows what else. So we just decided that it'd be funny at first, I think, to set up an account which shows those things. But then it sort of turned a bit more therapeutic for us, because you don't just carry things physically, you carry a lot mentally when you're moving around, knowing that you've got this secret and you're operating under a false name and you've just done something quite extreme. So we wanted a space to basically talk about that.
Well, that's it. Because actually, when you say that, there's so much humour in a lot of the posts, but also like there's a real, like a huge amount of honesty about how the person is feeling that day, how you might feel towards objects or experiences. And I mean, is that something that feels cathartic?
Yeah. Also, people always point out the humour to us, which I find really interesting, actually, because our jobs are hilarious. Okay. Like, honestly,
yeah,
it's ridiculous. Like, you will literally sometimes you will walk out of a booking and be like, what
is my life?
Really?
Like, yeah. Honestly, the first time we met, I mean, I don't know how explicit we're allowed to be on
this. Please be very explicit. So, because also I do have some logistical questions. So when you say like you got on a booking together, was that a client saying, oh, I really like you and I really like you, will you come around together? Or is it a client?
It can be. I mean, you can advertise that you love to work with someone, which is now on my profile, for example, because we advertise online.
Yeah.
I would recommend and that we like to work together. But when we met, it was just through a client, I guess, who decided it
you
would
two
be fun
get on.
To get everyone.
You two get on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they do make strategic choices like that. Like, yeah, they think your person, they matchmake. It's very strange. Like, I've got a lot of friends who I've met through a client thinking, like, oh, you two will get on quite well. And
wow,
we did.
Are these very rich clients if they can afford two people?
No, not always.
Yeah.
I think it's actually quite a misconception that we're sort of like swanning into high-end hotels and, you know, we're always swanning through the corridors at the Ritz, when half the time it's a Premier Inn.
That's the same with comedians, actually. It's the same. People always assume after a gig you're going back somewhere swanky, but actually it's all on a budget. Yeah.
Yeah. Traveling first class, not a hope in hell with that.
No.
No.
Yeah, no, but this client I think is pretty...
He's one of our favourites, isn't he?
You get well looked after by him, yeah.
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 I mean...
We met.
Yeah.
Do you want me to go into that story?
Yes, please.
So we got booked as a foursome booking. So it was me and Bella and then another service provider who was male.
Oh, which wow. I wasn't really a fan of, because usually get paid to have sex with men and not the other way around. But, you know.
Yeah.
It was the first time both of us had worked with a male service provider, actually.
And so that was someone, so you had to work with the male service provider, or all three of you worked on the client, or a mixture?
It just sort of turned into, because he was bi.
Yeah.
And that the client had wanted a bi escort to join.
Yeah.
Bi male escort. And so, yeah, it was, I'd never experienced that before. And I don't think you had either, right? Because we're talking about
no.
it after.
I was well excited.
I was a bit apprehensive though, because I don't know, the dynamic is different. I feel like typically female escorts are more like, you know, oh, like loving and kind, whereas there was some real sort of like charged masculine energy in the room. Like the way that they had sex, I thought was really different. I don't know if I'm just being...
Yeah, it was a bit strange, I think, but also because we were just like chatting away and realized that, because the thing is everyone thinks that you go in and it's like really hot and steamy straight away. It's not, half of it, especially when there's more than two of you, half of it is logistics.
Well, that's what I was trying to imagine. Like, it's so complicated, even with two people. Even, it doesn't matter how, like, you might be really in the moment and feeling really sexy, but it's still lots of, ow, your elbow's on my hair, or no, my arm's gone dead. Like, there's lots of things that are absolute mood killers. And, I can't imagine. You need a choreographer. You need someone, like, standing off to the side and then go, okay, you do this now.
Yeah, I mean, the best bookings are where you can say those things and laugh at them and everyone's relaxed, rather than it constantly being a performance, which is really what this booking was. So we were just sitting there chatting, realizing that we had loads in common. We're both writers, both had civ jobs doing the same thing. And we're just chatting and getting along, but also at the same time, it was we were talking to each other while anally fisting this other service provider. And it was like the first time either of us had ever done it.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So if you've got to do something for the first time, have you like read up on it beforehand? You've kind of thought, okay, this is, or does that person say, this is how you do this?
I tend to be quite honest and say if I haven't done something before. So if I'm asked for something and, you know, usually I would probably respond like, oh, that sounds really fun. That will be a first for me. Can't wait to try it, so that they're not expecting this pro to come in with the strap on. I mean, that's what I did the first time I had to, you know, peg someone. I was forgetting the word there.
Because
I thought, this is going to be a mess if I don't really know how to do it, but I'm pretending like I do. And
also presumably dangerous. Anything that's going to go inside somebody's body, like you would want to be careful rather than like gung-ho, I'm sure I'll work it out once I'm in there, that kind of thing. Just for anyone listening, I know pegging is quite a common word now, but I said it the other day at a party and my friend hadn't heard it. So I'm just going to clarify for any listeners so they're not like on Google and getting fired at work. So pegging is when, and it's quite a straight thing, isn't it? So it's when a woman wears an artificial penis or dildo to penetrate a man's anus. Yeah, pretty scientific explanation.
That sounds spot on.
Is that something that's becoming more popular?
My clients, but then I kind of explicitly say that I like to do that.
Oh, so great. Okay.
I'm not sure. What I have noticed though in the last couple of days, because I've had to go back to work now, and I was having a break before, but now it's sort of like trying to get back into it. Need to make rent, everything.
Yeah.
So I've noticed that the clients are younger. They've been my age. And I think that's because of social distancing and clubs being closed. Now younger clients are paying for sex, which
I find really interesting.
Strange.
But also because the dating websites, because everyone's been so cautious and in bubbles, if someone's normally using like a hookup website, maybe that's quite complicated at the moment because people don't want to meet up, or they want to wait a little while, or they can't risk kind of... Isn't that interesting?
It's a moral dilemma about, like, you know, meeting up with anyone at the moment. Mm. So I've been trying to tell them what my protocols are, but you can't, it's not really an exact science. I've just been asking people to be as honest with me as possible about what they're doing. And they're like, I never leave the house. So I just wear a mask everywhere. And and then suddenly on the booking, it's like, oh, and I was at dinner yesterday at this lovely French restaurant. It's like, no.
So with these younger clients, does it tend to mean that you're the first person that they've ever been with like this? Is that the first time they've ever paid?
It wasn't. I can imagine that could be the case, but it wasn't in my case. It was someone who. So today, this morning, and I had to do a yoga role play.
It was in the morning, first of all. And a yoga role play.
I've never done yoga, ever. My girlfriend did forced me to do Pilates with her on Zoom. She lives in America, but we did, and it was the time different. I was doing Pilates at like 2 a.m, my time, our time, and found it really difficult. So I just stole a few moves from Pilates.
Yeah.
I then found out he does do yoga. So he was probably like, what on earth is she talking about? We don't do that in yoga, but he just played along.
Yeah. It's so interesting when people know specifically what they like. But you must see that a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was actually a case of in the past, he'd said that he'd seen a couple of escorts, but it hadn't gone well for him. I hate when they say that because it means such a different thing to what it would mean for it not to go well first. But yeah. Anyway, he had a bad experience.
Okay. And, so what does it mean what does it mean for them?
Oh, just that. I don't know.
It can be anything.
Yeah.
It can be anything from them feeling like it wasn't a good enough experience to them like quibbling over money, them feeling nervous. Because a lot of the time, like, there is a lot of nerves. There's a lot of nerves that you see in clients when you walk in the room. And like the main thing is to try and combat that really quickly and make them feel comfortable. So if Pete, so like if you're having like an off day, like say, like that, it's hard enough to get your brain in gear, let alone having to rely on then having to do that for somebody else. So it can literally be anything.
Yeah.
They can be going through agencies and they feel like they haven't been, they haven't had the best experience with an agency.
Yeah.
False advertising. Someone used the phrase. It was like, ugh.
Oh, advertising. Like so as in, oh, okay.
As in, yeah. You're not like your pictures, or you know, you're bigger, you're smaller, you're this. You've changed your hair color.
Yeah, I get that all the time. The hair color thing.
Hair color.
Yeah,
oh, yeah, that's a big one.
And then what about and then on the flip side? So a bad booking for you guys. What kind of thing does that entail?
At the very worst end, you know, it could be something that is very traumatic and or life threatening.
Yeah,
and. On a more, you know, luckily, well, I think we both feel very lucky that we haven't experienced that level of conflict with a client. But we've both had our moments for sure. And a bad experience for me, for example, was being chased around a hotel room with an electric razor by some coked up man who just thought that would be funny. And obviously you don't know in your head like at what point is that joke gonna stop being a joke. And so I think I try to avoid any clients who are taking drugs now, just because like coke puts them in a different headspace.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there peace of mind when you get booked with somebody that you know? Do you have less concerns where you go, oh, well, Annabelle will be there, Bella will be there, we're together?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what it is, whether you just feel less, you feel more safe because safety in numbers, and they seem less likely like they're going to try something. But also someone knows where you are. And it's just nicer. You share the work, you share the load, like it can be fun.
Yeah,
and because that can be a laugh.
What you described earlier, like what people call like emotional labour, where the beginning part of the job or the booking is, I guess it's easier if there's two of you to chat and make someone feel at home or feel comfortable, because it's not just one of you thinking, okay, what do you need? How quickly can I like make you feel less nervous or something?
Oh yeah, and there's like more needs in the room. I like working with someone else because often, you know, there's someone else who wants a cup of tea at some point, and then there's more breaks and stuff. And
breaks.
It's true. The actual erotic labour is such a tiny, tiny part of any booking, and that's why it's so hilarious, because that's what everybody focuses on.
Of course.
Actually, your main job, well, the admin is unreal. And then your main job when you get in there is talking to someone, is making them feel comfortable. And I just talk at them as soon as I walk through the door. I'm just like, this is how, oh my God, it was a nightmare getting here. And isn't it warmer? Oh my God, the rain. And you just talk at them and you literally just see their shoulders fall about 4 inches from their ears.
Yeah.
And that's when you know that they're going to start easing into it. But if there's another person there, then you just do it to each other. So even if they're too nervous to talk, it's just like a bubble of conversation.
Yeah. That's so interesting. When you say there's so much admin, I think that's one of the really interesting things about your Instagram account, because the people like me who have probably, actually most people, if they don't know someone who sells sex, their ideas are all from like very kind of, they're either from like films like Pretty Woman or TV programs like Secret Diary of a Cool Girl, or, you know, like the news. So they don't have any idea of the reality. And it's something about the admin that makes it feel like such a human interaction between people. And also it's something that we can all understand, like all jobs have all of this stuff you have to do to be able to do your little slots of work. So can we talk about it a little bit in terms of like running, working as a business? So do you have to obviously like keep a diary, and then does your agency have your diary as well?
So we're both independent workers.
Okay.
We do not work for agencies.
You don't work for agencies, but so you would have like a website booking system, something like that?
Yeah, there's a website where you can advertise, which lots of people use. And it's sort of like Facebook, but for
porn. Oh, okay. That's it. When people come through to book you, do you have a vetting process? Is there any way that you can like check up on them or who they are, or is that impossible?
Yeah. So, I mean, there is ways, certain websites that you advertise on work in different ways, but a lot of the time, basically, when a booking's gone forward and you've seen somebody, then you have the opportunity to reciprocally offer each other feedback, and that's published on the site. So you'll sort of like read through people's feedback, but also you learn really quickly
what they actually mean.
Read someone's message.
Oh, okay. Like coded words. Is that what you mean? Like kind of...
In the feedback, there are coded words. Yes, when you want to give someone good feedback, but you want to flag up something without explicitly saying it, I think there's a few ways that you can do that. Or if you see the lack of a few words, I think the standard ones are like clean, respectful, and then all the rest are like sexy, gentleman, loved it, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But if you don't see clean and respectful, then you start to wonder like, oh, okay. Is that going to be
because I guess that would be something you'd want to be reassured about, like you, but also at the same time, would it be very difficult to write dirty man, awful? you couldn't write that on their feedback.
Not if you wanted to see them again. It's a trade-off, really. Like,
yes, I see. Okay.
Yeah, but it's less in the feedback and more in what they write and how they approach you. So like if someone's like the famous like sex worker message that everyone always gets, so like 4:30 in the morning and it's always like, you avail.
Yeah.
Well, they haven't like, even finished the word available. They're that busy.
No.
At 4:00 in the morning. They've got no time to finish the word. You avail.
Yeah. You avail.
And what does that kind of tell you about that person? Like, and or the kind of their current state?
It will be that they're not serious. A, you look at the time in the morning when they've sent it and you're like, nah, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
They're probably coked up or they're drunk and they're awake and they're just sending out messages to see what will happen. But there's a lot of things like, you know someone's serious when they're like, hi, I'm this. I'm looking for this for this long at this time in this place. Would you be willing? Are you free? Are you happy? Yeah. And like also notes that they've read through your profile, because a lot of the time they'll ask you questions and you're like, if you literally looked on the first page, it's right in front of you.
Yeah.
So you learn, it's really weird. It's subtle, but you pick it up really quickly.
Yeah.
Who's a time waster and who's not? Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Well, I was thinking about the late night coked up guy. Actually, I'm sure some people will just be trying to masturbate, trying to get sexy messages from people, like trying to do the initial stuff. They must be, mustn't they? Like the time.
Well, I've fallen for that when I first started. Yeah. Like someone who's like, could we just have a quick phone call to discuss what we're going to do on the booking?
Yeah.
And then I'll make the request. And so I had like a 1/2-hour phone call with this pervert who was like, and what would you be wearing? And what would you do this? And if my wife was here, what would you do? And I was like, just so new. And I was like, I would do this and I would try to do this and I would be really professional. Yeah. And then obviously never heard from them again. And then realized that actually that's just what they do, what this guy does.
I had it recently on I'm doing like charity videos for Choose Love. And mostly what people want is just to like say happy birthday to their mom or congratulations on your baby. And I didn't realize for ages that this person was a foot fetishist, because at the beginning, because it was such an innocent thing. So the first time, and he was pretending to be a woman, and he was like, oh, I just wanted to ask you a few questions. And so like, first of all, like he wanted to see my shoe cupboard. He wanted me to like, he's like, what's your favorite pair of shoes? And I just didn't realize. So to me, I wasn't thinking, obviously that's a kink for some people, seeing people's dirty shoes. And then he rang back again, not rang back again. He said, that was a great video, and this time I'm gonna, this is gonna be a quiz, answer quick fire. And the first question was like, when's the naughtiest you've ever been? And then it was like, what places are you ticklish? And again, I just didn't realize. And then the third time, he wasn't even hiding it anymore. He's like, tickle yourself for half an hour, show me the, and I was like, oh, I see, this is a kink thing, pay people properly, like. I then realized, and I was like, there's nothing wrong with it, but I'm not doing it, pay someone properly to do tickling themselves stuff.
Yeah, I'm really glad that was your response. Yeah. Go and pay somebody who actually does this.
I've learned a lot about like not kink shaming. So I think sometimes people can be, especially I'm a very vanilla person, and sometimes people can be so scared of other that their actual initial reaction to just like they find out about fetishes or kinks or people who have ever sexual practices. And it was research in my books taught me so much about like, you don't yuck somebody else's yum. But sometimes you go to a professional, or no, thank you, not for me today.
But I mean, that is one, I mean, I've got like a sociology degree. So to me, that's just absolutely, that's the most fascinating part of my job. And I love it when people come to me with weird and wonderful things.
Yeah.
Yeah,
like,
me too.
I've had a guy who made me gunge myself.
What? Really? What does that mean?
Yeah, like, you know, like Dave Benson Phillips, like get your own back gunge.
Yeah, like the twins kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, gunging.
Yeah.
So did you have to bring the gunge, or did he have it already?
He made me pick the colour.
Yeah.
And then he had it set up in like a paddling pool. And I just had to kind of like roll around in it. It was great. I was fascinated the whole time.
Yes,
there was like no sexual contact.
Yeah.
But he was really getting off on it. And to me, that was fascinating.
It is fascinating. Do you ever get to, I mean, I'm sure it would depend on your relationship with the client, but do you ever get to kind of ask them a bit about, when did you realise you liked this? Or is that not kind of done?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I always want to know. I always want to interview every client, because I think it's like having a superpower, having a weird kink. It's like, how did this happen to you that you can find it really erotic when this very seemingly innocuous thing happens? Like a ladder in a tight. Like there was someone who would just orgasm if he saw a ladder in tight.
That must be so awkward in rush hour on the tube.
Exactly. How did you first find out? Was it like, you know, in public or at school or what? And it often, I think people trace it back to some kind of formative experience, which is really interesting when you start to see how people have mapped. I mean, not to like kind of pathologize BDSM and say that everyone with a kink has got some sort of experience that explains it, but I think for a lot of people, they have had an experience in their past that perhaps they were afraid of, and then found that over time they sort of sexualized it and then really came to crave it, which I think is interesting. There was a guy with the castration anxiety who had that, where someone like one of his mum's friends said to him when he was young, oh, if you don't tidy your room, I'm going to chop your dick off. And that just stuck with him. And then, oh yeah, this actually, I thought of this when I was reading your book, because of the chapter where you were talking about going on a spree of kicking boys in the groin at school.
Yeah. My book, of course. This is a good chance to remind you that I have a book also called Sex, Power, Money, like this podcast, which I wrote about my journey finding out about human biology and arousal and why pornography works so well and the history of it, and investigating sex work and stigma and all kinds of things like that. Please read it. My publishers will be very pleased if you buy it.
And obviously, and I think a lot of us, when we first found out that that was something that really hurt them, thought it was hilarious. Like, I found it really funny. We used to joke on the bus about that and how we would sort of like sneaky do it when the boys getting off the bus or whatever. And he and this client had obviously picked up on that sort of cruel, mocking, cackly, witchy side of femininity, which is like, ha ha ha, it'd be so funny if your dick got chopped off. And then eventually taking it into this fetish where he was obsessed with like the Lorena Bobbitt case and wanted to read all about people who'd actually had their dicks chopped off.
Oh my
God. And so the booking was all around me pretending and kind of demonstrating that lack of empathy and how pathetic I'd find him if he had been castrated and all that kind of thing.
Which it's really interesting.
I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think what's so interesting is like, so fear and sexual arousal, I think there's a wiring in the brain where they actually are very, very close to each other. And that's what you're describing, is that for some people, and it wouldn't be the same for everyone, because lots of children would have terrifying experiences which never became sexual. But if something happens, it's almost like the more you fear it so much, but you keep thinking about it, and then it hardens into something else. It's
and so it can be a way of sort of safely revisiting traumatic memories and reclaiming them as something that you are on your terms. That's something I found quite healing about like sex work itself.
Yeah. You're playing with trauma, aren't you, in a safe environment. Actually, no one, you're definitely not going to get castrated here. So we can go as close as possible to that fear where I'm telling you I'm going to castrate you, but you absolutely know I won't. Like,
Yeah. Although I did really want to look the level of an unhinged where he might have some doubts. But I think I've got too much of a honest, trusting looking face.
In terms of performing, because you must be... Because acting obviously is a part of your job. Do you ever get asked to do something and you think, oh, I'm not a good enough actor for that?
No. Clearly must think that we're great at acting.
No, that's what I was thinking. Because even like, sometimes I'll try it. My boyfriend doesn't want to do role play at all. But sometimes I will, like, even if I try, I like laugh halfway through the sentence because I can't even pretend very well.
I'm never like, and scene, take one. I'm a mermaid. It has to be, you have to be able to laugh, I think, and quite often you ease in through pretending that you're doing it and then it gets serious.
I see. Okay.
Also, there's something in the fact that we're already playing parts. Yeah. Like, even if we just get booked for like a standard vanilla booking, that we're already playing parts. Mm. So I think it just, when you get asked to do a role play, it's just an add-on. It's just a change of character.
And you know what? It's harder for me to do the girlfriend experience, to perform that like actual intimacy than it is for... I love when someone's like, can you pretend to be a therapist or whatever?
Or yoga teacher.
There's more... Yeah, and it's creative and I like putting effort into my character. And if someone is, you know... getting genuinely over attached to you, which happens, and then they're starting to blur the lines, and then you're realizing, oh, maybe I'm acting this girlfriend experience a bit too well, and now I'm faced with a situation where I have to manage expectations between bookings and try and like remind them without losing their custom, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So I find the hardest acting work I do is just like the really basic stuff, like romance.
Yeah. So with that, because it must be an incredibly precarious situation, there are people who know that they're paying somebody for intimacy and or sex, but also really want to believe that that person also has feelings for them.
It's a really tough, some of them get it and it's great. I love when a client is just, I think what was, I remember saying with you once on a booking, I prefer to like scratch an itch kink wise than like fill a void and be someone who's clearly very lonely and craving company, be their only sort of source of intimacy. Because whilst that's good and to be able to offer, I feel like it can be very burdening and feels very, there's times when I've left thinking like, I just feel sorry for him or And then it goes from, and you know, you can kind of convince yourself sometimes like, I am just being a very nice nurse, I'm providing a sexual service. And then sometimes when they get that wrong and they start to really feel like you've got connection, they turn into like, you know, someone that you're being very benevolent towards, from that into like a creep. And it just, it feels, I don't know. But then, and I think, especially when the way that you're working in the US, for example, with it being fully criminalized, the setup is so different in that you can't say that you are a sex worker. It's all done sort of like you're dating and you get a gift. And thank you so much, so generous that you gave me this gift. But you can't say, and you have to be out after 3 hours because that's the time you've paid for. So the ambiguity is even worse, and then they get even more confused and think that you actually are dating.
Yeah. So it just adds an added level of, it seems like, difficulty and danger there, because you can't have clear boundaries with somebody because it's criminalized. It's absolutely so interesting. You mentioned earlier about having you used the word civ about like civ jobs. And so is that short for civilian?
Yeah. It's a non-sex work job.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And so how does that work in terms of balancing these two areas of your life? Do you have complete separation? Or is there some overlap?
I am not the best person to ask this.
Are you not? Okay. Okay.
My civ job is... Mm. I work within the feminist violence against women charity sector.
Okay.
So it really, really intertwines.
Okay.
Do you ever find it difficult?
If it intertwines, but have you ever found, because there's this, it's an odd thing within feminism that some feminism is very unhelpful to sex workers. Do you ever have to deal with that, with the kind of people that you're around?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Just making
change from the inside.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I mean, neither of us are out, as sex workers. So it's difficult, and you have to influence from the inside and be like, well, maybe this or maybe that.
And that's so stressful, because the sad reality is, if you, with the exception of probably you, the reality is that if you support sex workers vocally, people assume you are one, because only sex workers support sex workers.
Well, they think that you're using them is the other thing, is that I think a lot of the reason that men who are becoming educated then don't kind of talk about it, is they have an exact experience where people then think they're really pro, like for instance, decrim, they're really pro it because they want to be safer as clients or... and all of those kind of things. But I guess the stigma comes in lots of different directions.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember having a submissive client who had come from clearly did something really fancy, because he'd come from dinner at the House of Commons straight to pretending to be a puppy. And then afterwards, it was a training session from a dominatrix, which, so I was sort of there to learn. Yeah. And afterwards we all went for a drink at the pub, and this client was talking about how voraciously like pro sex worker he is, and you know, how he's trying to influence policy. But obviously there's that like, oh, do you have a vested interest then? What's your experience with sex workers?
Well, that's it. We see it with politics all of the time, that because people have such a short attention span, and lots of people have a lot to learn about, actually it's a long conversation about, well, why does the Nordic model not work? It sounds like that'd be much better. Or why should we decriminalize if we want to protect women? Like, it's a long conversation for some people. And politicians get put off because it looks like they're not interested in women's rights, or they want to buy sex themselves. And so they just think, okay, I'm not going to touch that hot potato.
Yeah, and it's difficult, because I think, like, when people think about it logically, they're like, oh, well, we think this is harming women, so therefore we make this illegal. But actually, like, when you look into it, that's not the problem. the main issue when it comes to policy and sex work is the fact that actually the vast majority of the time you're dealing with people who are being hit hardest by poverty.
Yeah.
And actually, by whether you're criminalising them or whether you're criminalising their clients, which is what the Nordic model does, and it's what's in place in Ireland, you're explicitly causing more harm to that woman who is either trying to feed herself, feed a family, put a roof over her head.
Yeah.
So it's like, actually, I understand that to a certain extent that you want to help, but if you want to help, you can't talk over us.
Yeah.
And that needs to be the agreement. There generally is in policymaking a lean towards listening to people with lived experience, but for some strange reason, when it comes to us, we're not trusted to make decisions.
Because we don't know what we're all sort of traumatized, broken flowers who don't know what's good for us, which is a lot of like clients think that as well, and then try and save you. And
that gets very
awkward, because I hate those ones, because it's like, if you think I'm vulnerable, don't also have sex with me whilst trying to save me.
Mm.
You should just help someone who's genuinely vulnerable.
Yeah.
And otherwise it's extortion. So it's really, I much prefer the clients that don't want to empathize because they actually see it as work rather than like, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that is hugely hypocritical. Like if somebody, it's still incredibly patronizing, but if somebody feels really like bad, then just pay and leave. You don't also get to have sex. You don't get to have both things. Like that is patronizing, but still, just do that then. Pay for your session and go home thinking, I did a really great thing today.
Yeah.
I paid someone for the work that they did.
Yeah.
What a wonderful world that is.
Yeah. Yeah. So in terms of, there was something that Jason said earlier. I was talking to Jason Domino. I don't know if you know him. Jason Domino was the first episode of this series, if you haven't listened to that one already. We at the end of our podcast, we hadn't like covered enough stuff, and we were talking about, he'd wanted to talk more about why decrim is much better than the Nordic model. And the example that he used, that he says he always uses with people, is that he explains that if a client is criminalised, then actually neighbours or housemates, all of these people who are around the sex worker who might on occasion like need to be helpful, will be so much more wary about calling the police or calling an ambulance or certain things, because they think they're going to get in trouble. So actually it means that the whole framework around somebody can't be supportive if they're also worried about things.
Also, just like the current countries where the Nordic model is in place. So Nordic model is, I don't know if your listeners know, so that's where the buyer is criminalised. So they can get hit with a fine or a jail sentence. But actually, there's so much more to that, because it plays into a lot. There's a lot of brothel keeping laws as well. So we have this in this country, so we can't actually work together.
Yeah.
So me and Bella can't rent a flat and work together, because that's considered brothel keeping, but that's the safest way for us to work. Now, in Ireland, where it was brought, a sort of Nordic model was brought in, but as far as I'm aware, there's been very few actual prosecutions of buyers, but two women have gone to jail for having worked together.
Well, that's what it seems to be, that whenever there's regulations, it's always used against the people selling sex, actually. It's used to punish them and make them be scared, very difficult relationships with police trying to enforce certain things. And so that doesn't surprise me at all, even though it is obviously, people don't have that idea of it. They think it's going to protect people.
Yeah, and it doesn't. And it does, I mean, to a certain extent, that does play into our work. I mean, we had one, a pal who's a worker who got beaten up by a client, and the police turned up and were just a bit like, well, kind of like, what, you know, and that was their reaction. And she had like a black eye out here.
Yeah.
And it's like, it doesn't matter what was happening. You don't consent to being smacked. Like,
no, that's a crime. Can you find the criminal, please? It should be so black and white. It absolutely should be so black and white. I mean, in some instances, people don't even call the police because they expect a certain kind of non-reaction, or them not to do their job because of what they do for their job.
Yeah, and actually there's the majority of the research that's coming out, especially from Nordic model countries, is that actually it's not helping. There's not a rise in prosecutions. It's pushing it underground. There's actually, it's making practices more unsafe. sort of like condom usage and stuff is being pushed. And it's just, and also on top of that, you're taking away the buyers. So then these workers can't support themselves.
Sure.
Because at and the then, end of the day, if we can't pay our rent, it's just another, you know, we need to feed ourselves. And it's very similar when Foster came in America. So Foster was a rule that basically meant that any website that was seen to have been hosting ads for trafficked victims were open to the ability to be sued, and the website could be sued, whether they knew that was happening or not. And literally overnight, websites shut down, Backpage shut down, Craigslist shut down. And overnight, workers in America lost their ability to make money. And there was nothing. And there was, it was so badly worded as a policy that everybody started panicking. There was like Google Docs of safe lists of like people not to see that were just taken down. PayPal accounts were shut down. Venmo accounts were shut down. You name it. Like everyone just lost their money. And it's just, that's terrifying. That for us is terrifying.
Of course. I think that's what I was going to say is that what people don't understand kind of necessarily is that when you make someone's, I guess, their supply more difficult, or no matter what their industry is, they don't stop needing money on a regular basis. We all need money to eat and to live. So what happens is, especially for a sex worker, that then changes what they might have to do or where they might have to meet clients, how they then get work. So that means instantly you're putting people in danger, not protecting them. You're meaning that they're going to have to maybe, you know, change their own boundaries, all different kinds of things. And yeah, what you're describing with America is like, instantly huge swathes of people who had a rhythm, who were able to search for people online, take credit card bookings, they knew that it was people's actual names and all those kind of things. I just want to clarify that trafficking and sex work are completely different things, and they're as different as I think of like stealing or shopping. One of them is a crime because the people that are involved cannot give their consent, either because they're children or because they don't have any choice. So it's absolutely a crime, and punishing sex workers for what's happening with sex trafficking is like punishing Sainsbury's because of theft, shoplifters and that kind of thing. It's incredibly unfair, and the two things get added together and they shouldn't be. Trafficking is absolutely horrendously awful, and no one in sex work is trying to defend that.
And it was literally like, you're saving them from the big evil man who's coming to have sex with them, but you're not saving them from the big evil system, which is enforcing poverty on them.
That's exactly, you know, when with COVID and everything, where, you know, it's like, where's everyone who were advocating for women, you know, having recourse to public funds? Where are you now? Like, you know, when sex workers are in financial crisis, where are you saying, like, you know, so they're not working anymore, how can we help? But it's all you know, it's all just really about the censorship of and the arbitration of the industry itself, and people in it suffer.
It was, and it was a real moment, and it was really seen across the industry, where we were all kind of sat there going, well, go on then. This is your chance. All these years you've been going on about how you want to break women free, you want to break workers free from this awful situation that they're in. Now's your opportunity. And I'm telling you what, not one of them stuck their head above the parapet. Like, we're really lucky. We're like, throughout COVID, we come from a position of real privilege. And we know that. I mean, our work's dried up and we've both struggled. But also there's so many sex workers in this country who are here in this country paying taxes, contributing, but they have no recourse to public funds. And they have literally been left on the sidelines. And these, you know, these feminists and these groups that have been trying to bring in the Nordic model and have been trying to sort of like cut off supply for years were nowhere to be seen. And this was their real moment. And they were nowhere.
Well, you're absolutely right. And it hadn't even occurred to me. But actually, all of the people who have like philosophies of exit strategies, this was their opportunity to go, well, here's an experiment. They've got nothing, like, mm-hmm. we could put this in. You're absolutely right. And it must have been so difficult, like, even because, I mean, there are organisations that kind of, like, unionise sex workers. Did you find that there was kind of unity in terms of, because no one could work, people were quite supportive to each other?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult because we're independent workers. So, like, as far yeah. as, like, actual unionisation, it's difficult for us to do that. Across the general industry, and it's really difficult because when you first start, and we both talk about this quite a bit on the page, but when you first start, you're very much out on your own. You don't know, more often than not, you don't know somebody else that's done it. You're kind of like feeling your way through. And for us, social media has been really important because it has meant that we've built relationships with other sex workers, and it means that we pass information around to each other that way, safety information. It's been really difficult. But there has been, I will actually urge, if anybody really wants to help sex workers and do something active where they're actually working towards helping sex workers, Swarm Collective, who are a collective of active sex workers, have set up an emergency relief fund. So please, please, please go and donate to that, because they're actually going out and distributing to that to workers who really are on their knees right now.
All you have to do is Google Swarm Collective and you can read about their work and who the money goes to. And also, if you remember from the first series, I interviewed the English Collective of Prostitutes. They are also supporting sex workers through this really difficult time. I know it's difficult for everybody in lots of different ways, but especially for people who aren't supported by our government. So if you do have a spare fiver to support either of those organisations, I think it's amazing because you can help them with your money, but also you show that people care in the community. But something you said just then, and it's actually must be such an odd situation, but when you say when you start doing sex work, you're on your own because you're the only person that you that it's not so that somebody kind of introduces you. So how does one kind of like make that step?
So the potted history of my walk into sex work, which I think I've been quite open about on Whore's Handbags as well. I was in an abusive relationship with a woman, I'm queer, and I left and I got out and my head was in a bit of a mess, and I moved back to a place where I didn't have to pay rent, which I was very lucky for, but also I had so much debt. I had so much debt from this relationship, and I couldn't, the thought of going in and working a 9-to-5 was like, I cannot hold this down. So
because of your mental health, you actually couldn't have coped at that point with something, because it is huge, what you'd been through.
I'd had a full-on mental breakdown, and I wouldn't have been able to hold down a 9-to-5 and pay off the amount of debt that I had. And I had read this thing, and don't judge me, in Vice.
Oh.
I know, I'm judging myself as I say it. About sugar babying. So I kind of joined one of those websites, and then I kind of was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Like, you know, it's fine. And I was getting paid in comparison, like peanuts, and people were really taking the mick. I did a threesome with someone on there, and they turned around to me and were like, get off there and become an escort. And I've never looked back. 5 years later, I've never looked back. I paid off my debt. I paid for my education. I can afford to live in London. I mean, even if it's the outskirts, but I'm still living here.
It's been life-changing for me as well. I don't think I would have, because it was also from a mental health perspective. I was struggling with childhood trauma basically, and couldn't hold down an office job where I had to perform this like nicey, happy kind of artificial person, which wasn't me at the time. That's how I got into it. It was just a way of supporting myself whilst being able to be a bit less performative all the time.
Absolutely.
Which is funny.
Well, that's such an interesting thing that people would never expect to hear, and I think it's really important for them to hear that it's about choice, about autonomy, And then it's about someone who's in control of their own, even if the past has been very difficult, like absolutely else, they're on exactly the same path to wellness.
Yeah, it's amazing how, I mean, not for everyone at all, and we definitely don't speak for everyone, and we definitely are aware that we have a level of privilege being able to advertise online, and also a client base who, you know, I feel that if you tick certain boxes by beauty industry standards, you know, like being cisgender or being, you have access to a client base who are willing to pay more because they see these things as more valuable, and that's messed up. So obviously can't, you know, say that this is this wonderful healing experience for everyone. Sure. And it's definitely had its really horrible times as well. But for me, it was a change in how I understood my own boundaries, and I found it really healing just to be the one whose terms everything was on. You know, like I do this, I don't do that. That's something I just wasn't used to being so open and forthcoming about.
Yeah, I don't think most people have that. Like, I think that is something that everyone should have in their own sex life. Like, sex is this really vulnerable time, and we should all have this language where we can talk about, this is what I'm really into or not, or today I feel like this, or today I don't. And actually, for lots of people, it's just all this big, scrabbly, embarrassing mess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Trying to perform something which doesn't involve, like, fumbling over a condom or bringing out the lube. And, like, there's lots of things that are omitted from porn, which... you know, as a sex worker, you get used to reassuring people that it's okay to get the wrong angle or whatever, or, you know, like get confused, and it's quite a human experience.
Yeah, it's very, very human. Because you've just mentioned porn, is porn quite a prescriptive thing for clients? Because people always assume that that's the case, that men watch porn and then that's what they want because they've seen it happen.
It's a difficult one. You definitely do have people who you will see who are like head down gunning for it. And they think that like you're just going to like squirt all over the room and you're going to be
the PSE.
And it's gonna be wonderful.
Is that the PSE? That when they ask for that, I'm like, no, I don't do that.
The what?
Yeah.
The PSE?
PSE is porn star experience.
Okay.
So it's giving them that fantasy that they see in porn, which some people are really great at. I just am not.
And is there a specific thing that that means, or does it just mean be porny?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Just the moaning and everything, you know.
Okay. Yeah.
But actually, like a lot of the people, well, I don't know. I mean, this is probably just my client base, but a lot of the people that I see don't want that. They don't.
Someone who they can sort of chat with, I guess. That's why they got us together, because we're like two really chatty, annoying, late, chaotic workers who come in with a whole load of issues that we need to express really? Before anything like ever comes off clothing wise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Actually, you just reminded me. Quite often people make, and it is quite often, people make documentaries where they talk to sex workers. And it seems to be that there hasn't ever really been one that sex workers have been like, okay, that's actually, you've reflected my lifestyle or you've reflected my job. Is that something you'd agree with?
The sex work experience is so wide, is so varied, is so complex and in its intricacies, but I don't think you could ever make one document. The thing is because we don't have these conversations, we rely on the odd documentary that comes up to go, well, this is sex work. Well, it's not. Like, so even if you're just going to take full service sex work, so full service sex work is what you'd understand to be a whore, a prostitute, an escort, a companion. That is so varied that actually... That's what in documentaries, that's what we need to be talking about. We need to be talking about the fact that this is a massive industry.
Yeah.
It is a massive industry. I can assure you that most people on this planet know or have known a sex worker in some capacity. And to try and boil it down to like an hour documentary with Louis Theroux and his producers being ridiculous, which was a whole other story.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you just can't do it. There needs to be more understanding of the nuances of the industry, really.
Yeah. Well, because one of the things that is difficult about documentaries in general is that they start with a story they want to tell before, it doesn't matter what it's about. They have the idea of where there's the, you know, the beginning, the crisis, the struggle, the resolution. They already have an idea in their head. So I think sometimes what they're doing is fitting people's lives that are nuanced and varied into that narrative, which means being biased with their editing. And then the other thing is, as you say, they want to talk to two people and then go, there we go. That's representative, other than going, and that was those two people's reality. Like, the end.
This is the entire sex industry. And it's not. I mean, we're what's classed as we're inside workers. So we have an we have one experience. That's not even beginning to touch on workers who work outside or workers who work in brothels or anything like that. So to try and, like you said, to try and boil that down into an hour documentary is just never going to work.
In terms of people listening, do you have any, not necessarily advice, but if there was someone listening going, oh, I'm really ignorant about sex work, I'd like to learn more, is there any resources or websites or things we'd go, oh, I'd send them there?
I think just kind of, I have my personal favourites, but again, there's so much out there. And I think it's quite specific to individuals, what kind of narrative they want to see, you know, or if they want to learn about stripping or if they want to learn about cam girls. I guess probably hone it down. If you want to learn about sex workers, the first thing to do is to realize how many there are, and to kind of make sure that there's a variety in the kind of like stories that you expose yourself to, because some of them, it might be really sobering, really bad experience, and really horrible, and they shouldn't be cut out of the narrative just to justify the experiences of some people who are empowered and happy. You know, I think it's important for as consenting sex workers for us to say that we are in support of people who need support exiting the industry and who don't want to be doing it, and do kind of want to share that side of things.
I should mention here that in the first series and in this series, when I've been interviewing sex workers, we do touch upon the very negative sides of their work, the dangers, the traumas, the terrible experiences that people have had with clients. But we don't go very deeply into that. That's partly because we're trying to do our best to educate people about the whole spectrum of sex work and not just the awful things that people may already have heard or presumed about it. And it's also because I'm not qualified. When I interviewed people for my book, some people told me horrific things, very upsetting things about sexual assault and rape and coercion and being taken advantage of. And those things are part of some people's experience of selling sex. So in some ways, what's been the discussions we've been having on the podcast aren't fully representative. And I was thinking, maybe if you wanted to do some exploration yourself, Rachel Moran, who is absolutely anti-decriminalisation of sex work, she has written an incredible book about her experiences called Paid For, My Journey Through Prostitution. And she's very graphic in it about some really horrible, horrific experiences. And I thought maybe that would be a place where you could go if you did want to hear more from the other side, people who've worked in sex work, but now don't believe that decriminalisation is the answer. Have you, with your Instagram account, you must have people who, for them, that's the first time they've kind of seen or read anything. Do you have people kind of going like, oh my God, my eyes are opened? Like when you guys describe your experiences.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's lovely, actually. We have, I think our followers are a mix of sex workers and then quite a lot of mums. We've got lots of mum followers.
Really? Yeah.
Who are, yeah, and it's really nice. They'll ask really lovely questions if ever we do like a question and answer thing, and then, or they'll send inbox messages just to say like, thank you for sharing, that's really opened my mind. It's a very sex positive little family that we've managed to find on Instagram, yeah. which is really nice.
It's important to note as well that with that page, we are really open to people asking us questions, and generally we are open to people asking us questions, because I think for both of us, it is educating. It is, like, we do see, like, that space as a point of, like, allowing people to kind of see the other side of it. That's not just what they, like you said, what they see in Pretty Woman, what they see in Secret Diary of a Call Girl, but actually it's us, like, pissing about in a bath in the middle of a photo shoot, or like something absolutely ridiculous, like taking parcels to a post office or something.
And also, I love that it's the realities of, you know, Thrush or lots of wet wipes, and you might have sex toys, but you might also have the book that you're reading, or so I find the incongruity of lots of those items. So I actually also find both of your writing, it's very beautiful the way you write about your experience as representations of the human experience. I took a screen grab of something because I thought the comment underneath it was so funny. And it's really beautiful. The picture has got like dildos and stuff in it, and it's got a Muzz magazine that you'd found in the hotel room. And I'd really recommend people do go to your site and read these things. So it's all about the collection of the items. And then it's like the journey, and then like the day off in the area that you're in. And then so you wrote in it, this is Bella, after pretending to orgasm 20 million times on our lazy client's cock, we were left alone. And then, so it's that sentence. But the comment at the end, and I thought this was so entertaining, someone had written, 20 million times, laughing emoji, I seriously miss the days when they didn't give a fuck about our orgasm. Sigh.
That was Theta Kalin, right? She's got a book called Anything But a Wasted Life, and she is quite active on Instagram as well. And she always interacts with us because she recognizes those just annoying things where it's like, why are they all? I know.
But you put underneath, you put in quotes marks like feminist clients.
Can they stop being feminist? I don't like the feminist clients.
Yeah, but
so
feminist means they care about like your pleasure, but literally giving
which
you
isn't
more work
our
to
pleasure.
Do. Of course,
exactly.
Yeah.
They just want the validation, and when they say I want this to be good for you, what they mean is I want you to perform for me, that you're having a lovely time, so that I feel really good about myself, that I've managed to be really, my sexual prowess is, you know, like, off the charts, than actually it's just annoying. I hate the ones that want to make it good for you, which I've found I've struggled with, even thinking like in a different setting, which is weirdly similar, like a therapy session. I feel like sometimes I fall into that trap of wanting to make it interesting for the person who's facilitating the conversation, and then I'm like, oh my god, I'm one of those clients who's trying to make it good for them. I should just take this for what it is, and like, you know, have put my needs first here, because
that's a very evolved way to look at it. But you're not saying to the therapist, is this good, is this interesting?
Exactly. Well, I've had to stop doing that, because I've realized that
am I your best person?
Yeah, I want to be special. I want to be your favorite. Yeah. I want you to love me. It's like that kind of thing. And the clients have that as well. So it's quite, it's actually opened my mind to how that's quite a human thing to want good feedback from the teacher and all that kind
of
thing.
With comedians, we all have the same thing, which is we want to make our therapist laugh. And therapists, obviously, especially if that's your default or your way not to be serious, they won't ever laugh at you. And it's almost like that's where you spend years with this person going, eventually, you're going to crack. I'm going to win this.
Have you managed or not yet?
Well, actually, my last therapist, I stopped going to her because she made a joke that she thought was so funny, and she just laughed for ages. She dropped her pen. She was laughing so much. And I was like, no, I can't. That was actually very serious. And she made this joke at the end about the program Naked Attraction. And I was like, no, I'm not actually paying for this anymore.
Yeah. For you to have a good old laugh.
Yeah, that's it. This is over. Thank you so much for listening to Sex Power Money. That was Annabelle and Bella. Please check out their Instagram account, Whores Handbags. And also, if you're a publisher, please give them a publishing deal, because I want to find out more about their lives and their work. Next week, I'm going to be joined by a photographer, an artist who is fascinated with masculinity and deconstructing it. Her name is Denisha Anderson. So I'll see you in 7 days.